Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn and Anne Ball. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Harley-Davidson's new electric motorcycle will soon be available through some dealerships in the United States and Europe. The electric motorcycle is seen as an attempt by Harley to appeal to a new generation of young, environment-friendly riders. But automotive experts say its cost, nearly $30,000, is too high for many people. They add there is little evidence the 116-year-old company's new bike will be popular among young riders. Harley-Davidson has long struggled to increase its U.S. sales. The American market makes up more than half of the company's total motorcycles sold. In 2018, Harley reported its sharpest sales drop at U.S. dealerships in 4 years. The company's U.S. sales are expected to fall again this year. As a result, Harley-Davidson's stock prices have fallen 42% in value over the past 5 years. Harley's new fully electric sport bike is called Livewire. It is much smaller than most of the company's traditional street bikes. The company says the Livewire can reach a speed of 96 kilometers an hour in just under 3 seconds. It can travel about 235 kilometers on a single power charge. Livewire has been available for pre-order in the U.S. market since January. The Reuters news agency spoke with at least 40 dealerships that will sell the bikes. Representatives told Reuters that most of the Livewire orders received so far came from existing Harley owners or older riders. Some dealers told the news agency they had received a lot of requests for information about Livewire from young people, but the bike's cost is making it difficult to turn that interest into sales. Interest is very high, one sales manager at a New Jersey-based dealership told Reuters. But once you get to pricing, interest is thrown out the window. One of the bike's main target markets is millennials, young people who were born after 1980. Gary John Pro is general sales manager at a Harley-Davidson dealership in Countryside, Illinois. He told Reuters most millennials cannot afford the Livewire, which is generally targeted at people who earn at least $100,000 a year. But Pro says he expects Harley to take a similar pricing path as U.S. electric car maker Tesla. Tesla's first electric vehicle cost over $100,000, but prices dropped sharply as new models were launched. Prices for Tesla's latest car, the Model 3, start at about $30,000. Traditional entry-level gasoline-powered Harley motorcycles cost about $6,900. The company has said it plans to launch 4 more electrified models by 2022. I'm Brian Lynn.
For 30 years, Alaska's northern fur seal population has not increased. But the ocean mammals are appearing in growing numbers in one unlikely place, a small island that forms the tip of an active undersea volcano. Bogoslav Island is distant and unpopulated. It sits in the eastern Bering Sea. Openings on the ground there release mud, steam, and sulfurous gases. But northern fur seals find the island to be a good place for giving birth and raising their young. Tom Galat leads a group at the United States National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. His group studies northern fur seals. Galat calls the population growth on Bogoslav extraordinary. Most of the world's 1.1 million northern fur seals live in the eastern Bering Sea area. The animals live in the ocean from November to June and return to land in summer when they breed and nurse pups. But it is unclear to scientists why the seals have chosen to live on an active volcanic island instead of other unpopulated islands in the area. The surface is covered with these big blocks, some as big as 10 meters in length, that were exploded out of the vent, said Chris Way-Thomas. He is a U.S. Geological Survey research scientist at the Alaska Volcano Observatory. About 635,000 northern fur seals live in the eastern Bering Sea area. They were first seen on Bogoslav in 1980. NOAA researchers have since carried out periodic studies of the population. In 2015, scientists estimated there were about 28,000 pups on the island. On Bogoslav, the seals hang out on the island's rocky beaches. But they are never far away from signs of volcanic activity. The center of the island supports a field of fumaroles, openings through which hot gases come out. Some make extremely loud noises. Mud bursts out from them and shoots several meters into the air, Way-Thomas said. Northern fur seals get their name from their extremely thick fur. They have about 60,000 hairs per square centimeter. When Russian Emperor Alexander II needed money and decided to sell Alaska to the United States in 1867, fur was one of the future state's known valuables. Between 1950 and 1988, the northern fur seal population dropped from 2.1 million to 1.1 million. Scientists do not know why they have not made a comeback. That's the million-dollar question, Galat said.
Teacher Coat Reith is a refugee from South Sudan. His students are too. They smile as they sing along with him in their classroom. Coat and his students are living at the Jiwe refugee camp in Gambela, Ethiopia. They have fled fighting in their homeland. Coat believes that education is the solution to a better future in South Sudan. Coat says he wants to make sure the young and the old are ready to take part in rebuilding the country.
I'm teaching these children to be the doctor and the president and the pilot. So this is my role, to volunteer myself to teach these children to be the good future in the South Sudan, to do a good thing.
He teaches his students how to read and write in their native language, Nuer. And he makes a point of adding a few words in English. Hoat Reith has been teaching for almost 10 years. He says children learn better when their classes are fun. Keeping their attention can be difficult in the camp. At any time, more than 100 students fit tightly into one room. This past summer, Coat provided extra classes to his students under an initiative of Plan International and other partners of the United Nations Refugee Agency. The idea is to help children catch up on schooling they missed because of fighting in South Sudan. He also teaches adults at the camp. South Sudan's conflict has had a major effect on children. Jui Camp is home to 54,000 refugees. As many as two-thirds of them are children. They lost their homes, and some saw family members killed. The years of violence have also prevented the youngsters from having an education. Some never even had a chance to start school, and many who did have dropped out altogether. Coat Reith shares much more than a love of learning with his young students. Like them, he is a victim of a war. He and his family fled to Ethiopia in 2015 after their home in Jonglei State was burned to the ground. Naimani Poor is a refugee student. She praises Coat's work in the classroom. She says, "I like how he teaches, and he is very funny. I like that." Coat and his fellow teachers are doing what they can to help their students. At this time, only two-thirds of South Sudanese children in Ethiopia can attend primary school. Most of those attending primary school, about 86%, do not and cannot continue on to secondary school. There are not enough classrooms, trained teachers, or teaching materials for the South Sudanese refugees. Coat is 41 years old and a father to 5 children. He admits to sometimes feeling tired, but keeps on going.
I'm tired, but I cannot say that I'm tired, because I'm forwarding the people to be like me or to be like other people who are here in the world.
The South Sudanese refugees learn in their native language and in English, while their teachers work to adapt to the Ethiopian education curriculum. Many teachers say their monthly pay of $27 is not enough, so they look for other kinds of work, but not Coat Reith. He has a purpose and loves what he is doing.
I love this teaching because I want to forward the young generation to be the good children in the future.
I'm Ann Ball.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. John Quincy Adams was sworn in as President of the United States on March 4, 1825. A big crowd came to the Capitol building for the ceremony. All the leaders of government were there, senators, congressmen, Supreme Court justices, and James Monroe. Monroe's two terms as president were ending. President-elect Adams focused his inaugural address on unity. Adams said, "The Constitution and the representative democracy of the United States had proved a success. The nation was free and strong and stretched across the continent from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific." He noted that during the past 10 years, political party differences had eased. So now, he said, it was time for the people to settle their differences and make a truly national government. Adams closed his speech by recognizing that he was a minority president. No candidate had received a majority of electoral votes. So the House of Representatives had to make the decision. The House chose Adams as the next president. He told the crowd gathered at the Capitol that he needed the help of everyone in the years to come. Presidents-elect used to give their inaugural address before their swearing in. So after his speech, John Quincy Adams took the oath of office that made him the sixth president of the United States. His father was John Adams, the second president. John Quincy's mother, Abigail, made sure he received an excellent education. Historian Harlow Giles Unger wrote a biography of John Quincy Adams. Quincy, incidentally, is how the family pronounced it. The historian tells this story about Abigail Adams and her son in 1775 in Massachusetts during the Revolutionary War.
When her firstborn son, John Quincy, was seven, they heard the cannon fire in the distance. They went up to the top of the hill behind their farmhouse and could look across Boston Harbor and see the Battle of Bunker Hill. And she took her boy by the hand. They went back down to the house, and she started melting down the family pewter with John Quincy helping her and making musket balls for the American Revolutionary troops.
Abigail and John Adams were strong patriots. They were one of the founding families of America. Harlow Giles Unger says Abigail Adams raised John Quincy to serve his country.
She told her son that if you do not grow up to be a great leader of this country, it will be because of your own laziness and obstinacy. She and her husband, John Adams, at that point decided to raise their son to be the President of the United States.
As a boy, John Quincy Adams learned to speak at least four languages and read Greek and Latin. He studied Shakespeare's plays. He traveled in Europe, He worked with his father in American consulates and embassies. He graduated from Harvard and was working as a lawyer by the age of 23.
He was a brilliant, brilliant young boy and man.
For about 25 years, Adams held mostly appointed jobs. He was ambassador to the Netherlands, Germany, Russia, and Britain. He helped lead the negotiations that ended the War of 1812 between Britain and the United States. And he served 8 years as Secretary of State. Adams spent most of his career working in public service. Harlow Giles Unger says he could be impatient, especially with lawmakers.
He despised most of the politicians he met in Congress because he found them to be ignorant and self-serving, with no sense of patriotism and sense of obligation to the nation.
John Quincy Adams did not care for political battles. When he became president, he tried to bring his political opponents and the different parts of the country together in his cabinet. His opponents, however, refused to serve. And although his cabinet included Southerners, he did not really have the support of the South. In his first message to Congress, President Adams described his ideas about the national government. The chief purpose of the government, he said, was to improve the lives of the people it governed. To do this, he offered a national program of building roads and canals. He also proposed a national university and a national scientific center. Adams said Congress should not be limited only to making laws to improve the nation's economic life. He said it should make laws to improve the arts and sciences, too. Many people of the West and South did not believe that the Constitution gave the federal government the power to do all these things. They believed that these powers belonged to the states. Their representatives in Congress rejected Adams' proposals. Harlow Giles Unger says some of the disagreements during Adams' presidency helped start the American Civil War more than 30 years later in 1861.
The country was now splitting. The South, most of the South, had never accepted the Constitution as such. The Constitution did away with state sovereignty, but many Americans never accepted that, and especially in the South.
The political picture in the United States began to change during the administration of John Quincy Adams. His opponents won control of both houses of Congress in the elections of 1826. Adams' opponents called themselves Democrats. They supported Andrew Jackson and wanted him to win the next presidential election. Democrats needed the support of both the West and the South to elect Jackson. So they proposed a bill that appeared to help the West. The bill involved import taxes. A number of Western states wanted duties on industrial goods imported from other countries. The purpose was to protect their own industries. Southern states, however, opposed the import duties. They produced no industrial goods that needed protection. They argued that the Constitution did not give the government in Washington the right to approve such taxes. The Democrats expected Congress to defeat the bill they proposed. They thought the West would be grateful that the Democrats had tried to help them, and the South would be happy that there would be no import taxes. But to the Democrats' surprise, many congressmen from the Northeast joined with lawmakers from the West to support the bill. They did so even though the bill would harm industries in the Northeast. The Northerners wanted to keep the idea of protective trade taxes alive. The bill passed in both the House of Representatives and the Senate. This left President Adams with a difficult decision. Should he sign it into law, or should he veto it? If he signed the bill, it would show he believed that the Constitution allowed protective duties. That decision would create even more opposition to him in the South. If he vetoed it, then he would lose support in the West and Northeast. Adams signed the bill, but he made clear that Congress was fully responsible for it. Democrats in Congress made other attempts to weaken support for Adams. For example, they claimed that he was misusing government money. They tried to show that he and his father before him had become rich from government service. Others accused him of giving government jobs to his supporters. This charge was false. Top administration officials had urged Adams to give government jobs only to men who were loyal to him. But Adams had refused. He felt that as long as someone had done nothing wrong, he should continue in his job. During his 4 years as president, Adams removed 12 people from government jobs. In each case, the person had failed to do his work or had done something criminal. Adams often gave jobs to people who did not support him politically. He believed it was wrong to give a person a job just for political reasons. Many of Adams' supporters could not understand. They had worked hard to get him elected. Their support for him cooled. Historian Harlow Giles Unger says, John Quincy Adams was never able to meet the high expectations many had for him.
His presidency was a complete failure. He was able to accomplish nothing.
The political battle between Adams' Republican Party and Jackson's Democrats remained bitter. Perhaps the worst fighting took place in the press. Each side had its own newspaper for support. The Daily National Journal supported the administration. The United States Telegraph supported Andrew Jackson. At first, the pro-administration newspaper called for national unity and an end to personal attacks. Then things changed. The paper had to defend against charges of political wrongdoing within Adams' party. It needed to turn readers away from these problems. So it printed a pamphlet that had been used against Andrew Jackson during an election campaign. The pamphlet accused Jackson of many bad things. The most damaging part involved the wife of another man.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.